From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You may figure you have a pretty good sense of what religion is all about, but do you?
To turn religion into a theoretical issue of whether you can logically or empirically prove that God exists or not is to miss the point. That's not what religion is about.
Religion, in a sense, works like a novel works, works like fiction. A good novel makes you suspend your disbelief. So does a good faith, a good religion.
Writing about characters who are sincere in their faith in God is far more difficult than writing even a sex scene.
Today, an unconventional look at religion, from its evolutionary history to the novels it's inspired. Also, why William James's classic book about mysticism, The Varieties of Religious Experience, still matters.
It's a book that people often cite when they reach out and put their hands on the books that have helped them to live.
But first, the charged and often treacherous divide between church and state. Georgetown professor Jacques Berlinerblau says, "We still don't know how to talk intelligently about religion in public life," and that's why he wrote a book called How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom.
I want to preface the remarks by saying secular is probably the most misunderstood word in the American political lexicon. The way I prefer to define it is to look at it as a political philosophy that is skeptical, maybe even paranoid, about any form of entanglement between government and religion.
It's been redefined by a lot of people as a synonym for atheist, though, hasn't it?
The term secularism was coined by George Jacob Holyoake in 1851. And what's really interesting is that Holyoake was adamant that it was not atheism. So I guess the confusion might have existed in the middle of the 19th century. In any case, we've been trying to pry the two terms apart for a good long time.
One of the problems I think people face with it is that they don't see that you can be both religious and secular at the same time. But you don't see a problem with that, do you?
Well, absolutely not. Atheism is a metaphysical, or better yet, anti-metaphysical proposition or discourse or science, if you will. Secularism is a political idea. It's a political conception which is deeply concerned, even skeptical, even paranoid, about any and all types of entanglement between government and religion.
But what it implies is that you can be both religious and secular at the same time, which a lot of people would take as abomination.
Well, the history of secularism is about religious people. The term itself, if we want to trace its modern genealogy, emerges from the thought, brace yourself, of Martin Luther, the great 16th century Protestant reformer. He's the first person to think very, very seriously about the possibilities of secular government. From there, John Locke, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison. These are all religious, in particular Protestant individuals. So we have to understand that secular is born of the Christian political philosophical spirit. It's not born of the atheist spirit.
So secularism came into being as a way of saving religion?
Well, it's kind of a herky-jerky development. Secularism as we know it probably comes into clearest focus at the end of the 17th and 18th century when people are just looking at the debris and the destruction of the wars of religion of the 17th century. And the question arises, how can we all live together if we happen to believe different things about the nature of the divine? And this is where secularism really has a valuable role to play.
So the secular is designed to save freedom of religion.
Absolutely. It's a very odd situation that secularism works so well that people actually forget what it does. And I think in the current frame of American history, we're seeing that right now. We're forgetting why in the mid-20th century, the United States Supreme Court decided to really pull church and state apart rather aggressively. We refer to this as legal separationism. But it worked swimmingly, I think, for a good 50, 60 years. And then all of a sudden, the question arises, well, why can't we have a little more religion in public life? Why can't a president say prayers? Why can't we invoke God's name in school? Why can't kids in a cafeteria at a public school pray? So, secularism sometimes works so well that we forget. Of course, if you look at the Soviet case, sometimes it works so horrifically that we try not to be secular.
Well, I wonder if you'd be willing to, from your perspective, answer a couple of those questions you just asked. Why can't a president say a prayer at a breakfast? Why can't a prayer be said in school?
Yeah. James Madison confronted this issue throughout his presidency, and his conclusion was you've got to let the unessential differences drop. If not, we're never going to get anything done. The reason I invoke Madison's name is my view is some of these things are really, really minor, and secularists, be they believers or non-believers, just have to let them go. There's something I called creche activism. Whenever a nativity scene pops up in front of a post office or a federal building, a lot of secularists go into a sort of emotional overdrive. I think a lot of those examples are really innocuous. They might be annoying, but perhaps secularism has bigger fish to fry. Then there are cases which I do feel threaten the core secular principle, at least in the United States, of disestablishment. And this is where we need to get worried. When politicians start speaking about the United States as a Christian nation, I think our fight or flight bells are rung. When a school has only one type of denominational representative come year after year to give invocations and blessings at graduation, or at commencement exercises, whatever they might be, then I think we have to be very, very cautious. The danger is religious establishment.
And that's why you have that odd bunch, Martin Luther and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, along with Roger Williams.
Yeah, the horror of establishment, and what I learned writing the book, is the horror of Catholicism. Isn't it funny how we forget about the American tradition of anti-Catholicism? And the 19th century, the second half of the 19th century, is a real high watermark for this type of irrational dislike of Catholics. And I regret to say, secularism has a lot of blood on its hands. There are secular governments that go catastrophically wrong. Case in point is the Soviet Union, which is in fact a form of secularism. So I don't want to fetishize secularism. I don't want to say it always works under all circumstances. I think when it does work, it's the least awful alternative for managing a religiously pluralistic society such as our own.
So the question is, what should secularists do? Because it seems as though they're fighting in the interest of everyone.
Right. Secularists have to first have reasonable expectations. I never thought I would come to this conclusion when I started this project about 10 years ago. They have to understand that the idea of absolute separation of church and state, which is an idea that I personally think is kind of swell, but it ain't gonna happen. And it's never happened. And in those places where they tried to make it happen, nobody would ever want to live there. So another thing I try to do in the book is to track the trajectory of this phrase, separation of church and state, which we secularists tend to assume is in the Constitution. But here's the rub. It's not in the Constitution. And a practical secular politics is going to have to confront that fact and move forward.
There's a lovely slogan you put forward at one point, secularism, freedom from religions you really don't like.
There it is, freedom from religions you really don't like. It's like the don't tread on me of the secular movement. And at its core, that's the takeaway from secularism. That's what it offers people. It says, you, Baptist citizen of Utah, you won't have to live under a Mormon establishment. And you, my Catholic friend living in Greenwich Village, will not have to live under a Jewish establishment. And I think most Americans are really on board with that conception of secularism. And I feel this is a good secularish way of living one's life, to love God or not love God. I apply the same logic to non-believers. But without losing your marbles over the existence or non-existence of God.
So it's not so important that you be wrong or that I be right.
You've actually read me very, very well. On metaphysical issues, I prefer living in a world where it's totally cool with me if you happen to believe that Jesus Christ walked on. I have no problem with that, as long as you don't have a problem with my strange congeries of metaphysical and anti-metaphysical beliefs. In fact, I don't even think we should discuss them. I think it's dangerous to bring them into the public domain. And I know I'm treading on some very unpopular ground here. I just think it's better we discuss those things in our theological seminaries or our new atheist cafes, and ideally in a college classroom, which is ostensibly where I live. Now, I'm Jewish, so Jews really understood the logic of it's better this way, not constantly discussing Jews in public, not getting into the ins and outs of halakha or rabbinic legislation. And Jews liked it sort of under the radar that way. And I often wonder if these insoluble, and by insoluble, I mean we'll never solve these things, if these metaphysical discussions, which are very good discussions, I would like to add, I would never want to foreclose the discussions altogether. I wonder what good it is to have these discussions in kind of public political space where you have politicians talking, Jesus did this, Jesus did that, or we detest this tenet of that faith. I'm very, very nervous about those sorts of conversations.
That's Jacques Berlinerblau. He runs the program for Jewish Civilization at Georgetown University. His book is called How to Be Secular. So, what do you think? Does secularism actually promote religious freedom? You can comment on our Facebook page, or send a note to our website at ttbook.org. Finding good fiction about religion is harder than you'd think. I mean, when was the last time you read a novel that takes religious faith seriously, doesn't demonize it, make fun of it, preach it? So here's a recommendation. Hanna Pulvanen's debut novel, We Sinners. It is loosely based on her own life. And Strange Champs wanted to know more.
Your novel takes us inside a very small, very conservative church community, the Lestadian Lutheran Church, which most readers probably won't even have heard of. You grew up in this church?
Yes, I grew up a believer, as we called ourselves, and it is an extremely small community with its own rigid rules, but I think that all fundamentalisms share similar conservatism. So I think the book is about more than just Lestadianism.
Who are the Lestadian Lutherans?
Lestadians are from 1850s Scandinavia, and they see themselves as returning to the true teachings of Luther.
Which means what?
Which means no more leniency. So everything from no nail polish, no makeup, to things much more important, like no premarital sex and no contraception.
They're not quite Amish or Mennonite, but there are a few similarities then?
They're not Amish or Mennonite in the sense that in a physical way, they're not trying to separate themselves from the world. They don't live in separate communities. They are public school teachers. They are engineers. They are carpenters. They are nurses. In the church, of course, the phrase that's always used is in the world, but not of the world.
One of the experiences you bring to life really vividly in your novel is the experience of being a teenager, coming of age, and having to navigate these two very different worlds, the world of public high school and the world of the church. Can you tell us about a couple of your characters and how they deal with this?
It's tremendously, tremendously difficult, of course, in adolescence to ever be different from everyone else. The characters really struggle with their sense of wanting to fit in, but knowing that they don't. And also trying to ask the question of when and exactly how do they go about telling other people what it is they believe. For instance, at the very opening of the novel, the character Brita is asked out to a dance, and she has to admit that she's not allowed to date outside the church. And she later discovers that the boy who asked her has revealed to the school that her entire family is brainwashed.
Is this anything that happened to you?
That's a secret.
And that really speaks, doesn't it, to the disjunction between these communities and the rest of the world. There's so little understanding on the part of the rest of the world of what the gift of that lifestyle can be.
The question of community is really at the heart of why I even felt inspired to write We Sinners. For myself personally, when I left the church, I felt that I had left this community and now there was no community to take me in. now it was just me. I was very alone. And I began to wonder, what is it the rest of the world does? Who do they turn to if their homes burn down, if something happens to one of the children, if the dad is sick and can't work? Who is caring for these people? And the answer is often, you know, the government to a certain extent. But in inside these communities, you get something that the secular world has a difficult time providing.
Well, I'm curious about how this played out for you personally in your own life. I mean, you said, like a lot of people who grow up in communities like these, you decided sometime in college to leave. Was that about leaving community or leaving faith?
I'm slow to answer here because the answer is embarrassing. I left the church because I was in love. And I was in love with someone who was not in the church. And to that extent, my choice was decidedly unabstract. I mean, I had felt bothered at the time by a number of, larger theoretical and philosophical questions, but it wasn't that so much that really bothered me at the root of things. What bothered me was that I was in love with this man and the church was preventing me from what I felt was a love that was good in the eyes of any God. And I think that question of why we believe, and are we believing for ourselves? Are we believing for each other, for our families? Are we going to church because our families go? Are we not going to church because our families go? That's a general question about faith that it was a major question for me as a writer going into the project.
I'm asking some of this because you've written that one subject that you obsess about is God. And I found that so interesting when I read it, because I often think that, you know, we're much more comfortable in today's secular world discussing our sex lives than we are talking about whether we believe in any kind of absolute.
And it's fascinating that you say that, because one of the struggles as a writer writing about God is that writing about characters who are sincere in their faith in God is far more difficult than writing even a sex scene.
Really? And, how so?
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
What are the pitfalls?
Oh, there's so many, because writing characters who sincerely believe, it's so easy to walk on the side of cheesiness. It's so easy for that moment to seem unearned. It's easy for those characters to seem, I hesitate to say crazy, but like they're having some kind of ecstatic, otherworldly experience that the reader is detached from. And it's hard. It's terrifically hard to try to write characters who are people first and who believe in God second.
That's so interesting, because on the other hand, America is a very religious nation. Why do you think it's so difficult to write believable characters and to write about their beliefs?
We live in a secular age, which is also terribly ironic, both in our national conversations about conservative religion and in our literature. Even if you look at the preponderance of TV shows, 18 and Counting or Big Love, or I mean, religious communities are absolutely, there's no doubt about it, they're being sensationalized. I think this happens also in literature. There's often characters who, if they believe in God, are rather pitiable characters. And for me, when I was growing up, I didn't necessarily have big dreams of being a writer, but I was a huge reader. And in my own times of wondering about this faith, I, as I always do, turned to literature, and I felt rather hopeless. I felt like I was looking around me for someone to speak about God and people who believe in God with real compassion, and it was more difficult to find than it ought to be.
Do you think people are afraid of fundamentalism?
I think people are unnerved by fundamentalism. I think they would rather not look at it too closely. I think also, when they do look at it closely, they want to quickly discern the ways in which they are not like that, which I think is all wrong. At the heart of things, even when I find myself watching a documentary about the Amish or something, I'm always trying to figure out, how am I like them? I mean, under what circumstances might I have been Amish? how is this life to them both normal and familiar, but also good?
You've written that you're not so much interested in writing about why people choose to leave these communities as you are in writing about why people choose to stay. Why is that more interesting to you?
Well, I think there's a number of memoirs which already speak to this effect. They tend to be more expose. It tends to be more, this is the oppressive culture I grew up in, and here's how I escaped. And I think it's much more difficult to try to relate to a character who chooses otherwise. And for instance, in one chapter of We Sinners, Jonas Chan is an outsider to this community, and he falls in love with one of the Rovaniemi daughters. And I found, even when I was writing this particular chapter, that secretly at the bottom of my heart, I was rooting for him to join the church. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that's actually what I was doing. I began to think somehow, let's go, Jonas. You can do it. You need these people. They can help you. You're so lonely. They will give you this love. They will give this to you. I think for me as a writer, if any other reader were to, in that moment, have that kind of experience, not necessarily with Jonas, but with any of the characters, to feel a sense of, I understand why you stay. I understand the compulsion. Then I think I have done all I could have ever asked to do.
Hanna Pulvanen's novel is called We Sinners. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps.
Good Lord up above, can't you hear me crying? Tears all in my eyes.
Up next, the deep history of religion. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. If you go way, way back in time, how did early humans first begin to practice or create religions? The renowned sociologist Robert Bellah spent much of his life pondering that question, and finally, in his mid-80s, he wrote a 700-page book called Religion in Human Evolution. Bellah died a few months ago. When his book came out 2 years ago, Bellah talked with Steve Paulson about the deep history of religion. He said religion is, above all, about ritual. And where does that come from? Play. A behavior we humans share with lots of other animals.
The thing that's interesting about play is that it has rules. There are things you can do and things you can't do. I mean, it's like ethics is already beginning 200 million years ago.
It's true. If you watch any kids play, you see 7-year-old boys arguing about the rules half the time.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of play is simulated fighting or chasing. If an animal pretends to bite, that's part of the game. If an animal bites, game's over. And if you want to play, you don't bite. We don't think of animals as having rules, but they do, and they have fairly complex rules. I think this kind of protected environment makes possible in the human species the beginnings of ritual.
You quote the developmental psychologist Alison Gopnik, who has this wonderful phrase, useful uselessness,
yes,
to describe
yes.
play. In other words, on the surface, play has nothing to do with an animal's survival. But on the other hand, it's actually tremendously useful in terms of helping those animals learn the social rules, learn how to negotiate with other animals.
The uselessness turns out to be useful. Creatures that are totally terrified all the time and trying to survive are not going to be very culturally creative.
Okay, so lots of mammals, including humans, play when they're little, and they develop rules for play, rituals. How does then ritual turn into religion?
Who knows? We're in a world where it's pure speculation. But it has to do with the fact that humans began to live in larger groups and not just in small kinship groups. And ritual is like play, a way in which one can do things together, sometimes synchronized, and humans are the only species that can keep together in time. Even chimps, our nearest neighbors, cannot dance because they can't keep the rhythm together in a group. They can be taught that by humans, but they can't do it on their own. But humans have the capacity to sing, to dance in time.
So you're saying you're saying that if we could go back 100,000 years and identify those first religious behaviors, they would basically be ritualistic?
I think ritual is the first form of religion, particularly if you think of the fact that ritual undoubtedly precedes language. There's a long history of debate as to which is the foundation. Is it ritual or myth? Myth, of course, is very important in every surviving human group, including us. Our society is riddled with myths, and I don't necessarily mean it in a pejorative sense. You listen to a political debate, you're not hearing rational argument. You're hearing one guy's myth being slung at another guy's myth. So myth is part of who we are, because narrative is part of who we are. We are our story. But the argument I'm making is the debate as to which comes first is over. Ritual came first. Hmm. And out of ritual comes myth. Because they needed myth, they invented language.
What we're sort of circling around is what we mean by the word religion. And
I know, and that's such a dangerous word because people already know what religion means, and that's usually wrong if you got outside the particular group that they were raised in. Many people think religion is whether or not you believe in God. If you believe in God, you're religious. If you don't believe in God, you're not religious. The very notion of believing in God is really a very special development. It occurred once in history in ancient Israel. It spread through successive groups that are totally dependent on ancient Israel for the most basic ideas, namely Christians and Muslims. So there's lots of them in the world. But there's hundreds of thousands of religions, and only three of them believe in God in this particular way. But since most people know only one of those three religions, they think that explains religion in general, which is the last thing on earth it does.
What about transcendence, the experience of another dimension of reality, what a lot of people would consider the ineffable? Is that a crucial part of a religious experience?
Yes, and of course, that's one of the things that happens in ritual. There is a sense of something larger than the individual. And you can see it in non-religious contexts in the way people behave in a rock concert, for instance, or an intensely involving football game, that their emotions and their sense that something is happening that's very important but beyond themselves as individuals is taking place.
So you would say, for instance, the truly passionate football fan who gets very caught up in the excitement of a game is basically engaging in religious behavior?
It's very similar to religious behavior. The thing is, you can turn it off, and you can't turn religion off. If you really take religion seriously, it's going to affect your life, not just during the ritual, but during the rest of your life. No, I think there's a whole range of behaviors that are linked, and chopping things up into what is religion and what is sport and what is art really violates the empirical fact that all these spheres overlap a lot.
Well, and a great example of that is theater in ancient Greece, the dramas, plays.
They were rituals. They began at dawn, and they were entirely ritual. And furthermore, the chorus represented the audience. So this wasn't a group of people that just came to see a play. They came to see themselves played out on the stage. They identify with the characters.
Now, you said that when we talk about religion, we tend to get too hung up on God, that really this is only of concern to the Abrahamic religions. There are many religions that don't even talk about God. You're really not getting into the great existential question, does God exist? Is that just entirely separate from this whole conversation?
Well, you know, the great theologians would say that's a non-question. If God didn't exist, you wouldn't be here. So what are you talking about? Aquinas said that. Paul Tillich said that. To turn religion into a theoretical issue of whether you can logically or empirically prove that God exists or not is to miss the point. It's not what religion is about. Religion is a way of life and only secondarily a way of thinking.
I've read that Paul Tillich had a huge influence on you when you were younger.
Yeah, and a lot of other people in my same generation. He was the apostle to the intellectuals. I had become a Marxist. I was an atheist. Paul Tillich said, religion is not belief in the unbelievable. And that hit me like a ton of bricks because I thought religion was belief in the unbelievable.
So he showed you how to be a Christian again?
Yeah, he did.
Am I right that you are a practicing Episcopalian now?
Yes. I was raised in the Presbyterian Church, so I went to Sunday school and so on, but not much of it stuck, I must say.
Is this important to you? I mean, the whole business of being an Episcopalian, going to church because of the community of fellow churchgoers? Is it sort of that ritualistic part of it more than actual belief in God?
I think God emerges from the whole life of the church, from the liturgy, from the ethics, and so on. If you think God is something that you're going to decide about in the privacy of your study, whether God exists or not, that's not what God's about. You'll find out about God if you participate in a community for which that word has some meaning. For me, the reason why I'm an Episcopalian and didn't stay with my mainstream Protestant childhood is because of the liturgy and above all the Eucharist, in which you actually enact the fact that you are part of the body of Christ.
Of course, there are a lot of Christians, Protestants, who wanted to get away from that because they thought, you know, how can we believe in this? You know, the intellectual Protestants. You're saying that's the thing that grounds you.
Well, I think Protestantism was a mistake, but it was a very necessary mistake. The Catholic Church was very corrupt. It needed shaking up. It needed a radical challenge. And a great many things that are important to us arose from the Reformation. But when the Reformation decided to abolish the sacred from this world, to destroy the sacramental system, to make the Eucharist something very marginal if it existed at all, to turn everything into words, 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 and ethics, and not much else, it lost too much.
Now, we haven't talked about the afterlife. And that, a standard explanation for why people originally created religion was to come up with an explanation for death. Does that make sense?
Not to me. I know that because humans have graves and they have grave goods in them, leads many people to presume that they believed in an afterlife. I can't see why it proves that. I think it could be equally interpreted as a sense of a loving care for the one who's lost. And after all, grieving is common among higher animals. Elephants grieve. Chimps grieve. Do they believe in an afterlife? The afterlife, in the first place, is not a universal belief. The very culture that gave us monotheism, that gave us Yahweh, that gave us the one God, that you shall have no other beside me, had no interest in the afterlife. You look at the Hebrew Scriptures, you're not going to find anything about the afterlife. It came in very late in Judaism, and it's, of course, very important for Christians and Muslims. But to this very day, you'll find many Jews who go to shul, who go to synagogue, who don't believe in an afterlife. It's not central for Confucian belief. It's certainly central for Buddhists because they think you're going to be reborn infinite times. So the afterlife is one feature of religion. It's certainly not universal and certainly doesn't explain religion.
Sociologist Robert Bella talking with Steve Paulson about his book, Religion in Human Evolution. Bella died a few months ago at the age of 86. One of last year's most acclaimed movies was Life of Pi, about an Indian boy who's stranded on a lifeboat with a Bengal tiger. Pi survives by his wits and by his religious faith, an eclectic mashup of Hindu, Muslim, and Christian teachings. The film is based on the novel by Canadian writer Jan Martel. We talked with Martel when the book first came out.
Canada is a very, very secular country, and I wanted to talk about religion in an uncynical, honest way. I was looking at mechanisms for living with evil. How do we deal with evil? How do we take it? How do we understand it? How do we live with it? And after all, we do have to live with evil. People die. People die in horrible circumstances. Injustices happen all the time. So I was looking for something to deal with that. And I thought, why don't I have a look at religion? Because for all the flaws, for all the things that are wrong with organized religion, one thing you can say about it is that it does have a very clear perspective on evil. So I thought, okay, I'll look at this. Surely if religion has been around for 5,000 years as far as the Jews are concerned, 2,000 years for the Christians, 1,300 years for the Muslims, surely there must be something grander afoot than mere patriarchy, sexism, etc. So I decided to take them seriously, to pretend I made a leap of faith, to pretend I had faith, to see what was good in those religions. This is Pi speaking. I'll be honest about it. It is not atheists who get stuck in my craw, but agnostics. Doubt is useful for a while. We must all pass through the Garden of Gethsemane. If Christ played with doubt, so must we. If Christ spent an anguished night in prayer, if he burst out from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Then surely we are also permitted doubt. But we must move on. To choose doubt as a philosophy of life is akin to choosing immobility as a means of transportation. At university, I considered myself, I suppose, an atheist. But since working on this novel, I've realized that the texts, the foundational texts, are astonishingly beautiful, deep texts. And I also realized that the question of truth and falsehood misses the point. Faith is a matter of interpretation. It's how you understand life. And that's why I make in this novel, I make a link between religion and storytelling. Religion, in a sense, works like a novel works, works like fiction. A good novel makes you suspend your disbelief. So does a good faith, a good religion. It makes you suspend your disbelief, and we call that faith. And once you have faith, whatever happens to you, you see through that narrative framework of religion. And so doing this research for this novel has set me on a pathway where I do see things in religious terms.
Jan Martel, talking about his Booker Prize-winning novel, Life of Pi. Coming up, the story behind one of the best books ever written on religion. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. What's been the most important book written about religion in America? There are lots of choices, but there is one book you would have to consider, The Varieties of Religious Experience, which was written just over 100 years ago by the philosopher and psychologist William James. I'm sitting here with Steve Paulson, who is a huge fan of that book, and so I'll just ask, why is that book so influential?
Because it changed the way a lot of people think about religion. I think before that, there was the common assumption that religion was all about how you read a sacred scripture, how you read the Bible, for instance, or what your pastor at church says about it. And James turned that upside down. He said, no, it's not that kind of textual authority. It's your own experience. That is what religion ultimately is about.
So who's William James and why was he able to have this much influence?
You know, there's that common phrase, spiritual but not religious. And I think that impulse really goes back to William James. And James himself, he was a fascinating guy. He had a really interesting background. He comes from this storied American family, and He never got a high school degree, never got a college degree, ended up teaching at Harvard for a number of years, but it really goes back to the way he and his siblings were brought up. His father was very open-minded. They didn't want any platitudes to come into the way they thought, and I think eventually he brought that to the way he thought about religion.
You talk about his family. Of course, for a lot of people, the brother is better known, Henry James, the American novelist.
William's younger brother, yeah. And they were very close throughout their whole lives. They were also kind of rivals. You know, they read each other's work. They also would critique each other's work. One way you could think about them is, to some degree, the study of consciousness was the family business. So William approached that in the way he thought about psychology, the way he thought about religion. And when you would think about what's the great subject of Henry James's novels, it's the way our minds work.
It is a remarkable family, and there's a lot to write about. In fact, you've interviewed the biographer of William James, Robert Richardson. What does he say about William?
Well, he's fascinated by William James, I think partly because James approached a lot of really difficult issues and was willing to live with uncertainty, was willing to say, I don't know. He and some other scientists studied psychics, people who would do seances and were trying to figure out, you know, was there anything real here? And the way Richardson writes about it, he says, William James was drawn to edges, fringes, borders, and margins. And that experience goes into his great book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. And the thing that's remarkable about that is, I mean, once you get past some of the language, it kind of feels like it could have been written yesterday.
It's a book that people often cite when they reach out and put their hands on the books that have helped them to live. And one of the things about the varieties is that it's almost all in witness form. What James does is to allow person after person after person, 45 people per chapter sort of, to say their piece, to say how it felt for them. And the result of this is this almost fire hose of primary testimony. You really can't argue it down, because here are all these people saying, this is how it felt to me, this is how it felt to me. And you add all that up and you say, now what religion is how it feels to each.
So what's so striking about James's understanding of religion is that he considered experience to be what's central. Did he equate religious experiences with mysticism?
No, he was looking for all kinds of religious experience, a feeling of a higher power, a feeling of well-being, a feeling of abandonment. Mysticism, though, for him remains the sort of blue flower, the best of the best.
What was his understanding of mystical experience?
The mystical experience allowed the individual mind to touch on what we'd have to call a world soul or a world mind, something larger than itself. And that feeling is mystically communicated and produces great contentment and wisdom and beatitude.
You haven't used the word God, but that sure is what it sounds like.
It does sound like that. And he would not avoid the word. What James is out to show, though, is that if you look at the religious experiences of all these people, each one seems to lead back in that direction.
So how do you think he thought about these things himself? I mean, I don't know if believing in God is the right question, but did he have some feeling of this underlying world soul? Did he have personal mystical experiences himself?
If he did, he is very careful to say he didn't, because he does not want to antagonize the people who were going to jump on him. For example, he went to a lot of seances and got in trouble with all kinds of people for his interest in spiritualism. And the scientists didn't like it that he even considered the possibility of seances and life after death. And the spiritualists hated him because he wanted the same kind of empirical proof for their claims that he wanted for oxygen and physical substances. So he had a kind of a no-win situation. But there again, he would say, if you have the experience, then that has to be counted as part of reality. James's position was that nothing's really settled. And he was unwilling to finally settle and say, well, yes, there is a supernatural, or, well, no, there isn't a supernatural. He kept it open in a kind of endlessly heroic way.
Well, what's also striking specifically about his investigation of these psychic experiences, and he wasn't alone in doing this. He had this little band of scientists he investigated with. I mean, they went to seances, they looked at mediums and tried to figure out, you know, who was the real thing and who were the frauds. Most of the ones they encountered seemed to be frauds. But there were a few who at least William James thought had real psychic powers, most notably a Mrs. Piper.
Mrs. Piper is James's exception. He once called her a white crow, proving that there could be such a thing as a white crow. She seemed able to read family dynamics in an astonishing way. Who in the James family was feeling badly, or who had died recently, or who had had to be buried recently. There is an enormous amount of material on this because James wrote down a lot of the seance sessions that he went to. And he was discouraged by almost every single session, and yet he didn't want to say it was a closed book. I think it's that final little refusal to say, ah, I have it. This is it permanently. It's sealed. He just wouldn't do it. Then one time he was up in Maine at a seance that was organized by a man named Dorr, who was the founder of Acadia National Park up there. And James went up in the winter to watch this small circle of mediums work around a brass rail. And he said he saw the brass rail move all by itself. It was daylight. He could see there was no problem with it. It very clearly moved, and it should have shaken his entire universe. And he said he just couldn't find himself believing it. It's a really fascinating little moment. Even when presented with what looked like the visual evidence, he wouldn't quite say this was it.
Well, there's a paradox, it seems to me, at the center of James's thinking, particularly about the mind and about these kinds of transcendent realities. On the one hand, he really thought that the mind was pretty much determined by brain function. He didn't think the mind was something separate from what the brain does. And yet, on the other hand, he seemed to be totally open to the possibility that the mind could communicate with other minds or other dimensions, which seems to be contradictory.
It does. That's very well put. What James thought might be true was that there might be a threshold in the mind where the individual mind touches a larger mind. It's a sort of Jungian idea. And it's a fair bet that Jung actually took this from William James, whom he read and admired, and that there's a possibility that our individual minds can touch that larger mind, that oversoul.
What I find so attractive about William James is that he is a visionary in the sense that he thought the world was open to all kinds of possibilities. He wanted to explore all these different sort of dimensions of reality. And yet he was also very comfortable living with uncertainty and ambiguity and the prospect that we would never know anything for certain. I mean, those are kind of two qualities that rarely go together, I think.
I think you are exactly right on that one. And one of the hallmarks of James's mind is this ability to hold conflicting points of view in his own mind, I think. And he doesn't try to slick it up into a unified system for us. He's willing to let it sit out there. And it is one of the deeply attractive things about him.
Now, he had a number of personal struggles himself, didn't he? I mean, for one thing, he said that he had to struggle with melancholy throughout his whole life.
That is true. It was worst, I think, in the teenage years or the early 20s when he didn't know really what he was going to do for a profession. And the person that he loved most, Minnie Temple, died on him.
And he had some sort of terrifying experience shortly after she died.
And he had a terrifying experience, very reminiscent of an experience his father had had after Minnie died, that he was alone in an asylum with a green-skinned idiot. And suddenly James saw that figure he was looking at was potentially him, and that there was just about nothing separating him from the sort of chattering abyss of insanity. And he pulled back from that, he said, and was not the same for months after that.
When you say he had a vision, this wasn't a dream. This was some sort of a vision in a waking state?
Apparently. The only way we know it is that the account of it is in the Varieties of Religious Experience, and it's attributed there to a Frenchman. But it's not a Frenchman. It's James's own. But he didn't want to put his own name on it.
Didn't he used to keep a journal? And those particular pages that would have been the time when this happened, he ripped out of his journal?
Yeah. Yeah, they're gone. One really does wonder.
Let's talk some about the influence of William James over the years. I suppose perhaps the most famous acolyte was Bill Wilson, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, who credited William James's ideas with some of the core principles of AA, right?
That's right. Bill Wilson called James the unacknowledged founder of AA. Because Wilson got the idea of trying to make William James's notions of conversion available on a wholesale basis, meaning to anybody who wanted.
What did he mean by conversion?
Conversion is this moment in which the way you have been will no longer do. The moment, for example, in AA comes when you admit your helplessness and your hopelessness. And you admit that you are no longer in charge of your own life.
So to some degree, you are surrendering to a higher power.
The self-surrender is crucial. And every religious tradition, going back into Sufism and Christian mysticism, all insist on this, that you have to arrive at the helplessness of the individual. And that admission of powerlessness in some way I don't understand. But I've been told again and again and again, that's the gate.
Why are you so interested in William James? I mean, you wrote your biography some years back. You've now edited a collection of his essays. Why do you keep coming back to him?
Well, he's one of the people whose books I pick up when I need help, when I need to be cheered up about the world or about my own life. I find reading Thoreau, Emerson, and perhaps above all, William James, the way out for me, or a way forward. I mean, he has a wonderful argument on the moral equivalent of war. Perhaps the central piece of his work, in his own view, is an essay called On a Certain Blindness in Human Beings, in which he talks about our absolute inability to understand the motives of people unlike ourselves. I think that's so deeply needed today and so relevant to my own life as I look around me all the time. That I don't know where better to find a more lively, more sympathetic mind.
Robert Richardson, the James biographer who's edited a collection of essays called The Heart of William James. He talked with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Do you have any thoughts about what you've heard today? We really would love to hear from you. Go to our website. It's ttbook.org. Or go to our Facebook page. You can buy a CD of the show by calling the radio store. It's at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the show Religious Belief, Secular Values. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was put together by Steve Paulson, with help from Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Veronica Rickert, Sarah Nix, and Doug Gordon. Our special guest engineer was Joe Hartke. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You'll find more than 10 years of archived interviews and shows on our website at ttbook.org, which you can stream, download, and share with friends.
PRI, Public Radio International.